book that you used to tell me about, did it ever...
No, no,
just finished doing it. And he's done lots of translations, particularly a recent, well, about 5 years old now, the Bhagavad Gita, a new translation of Bhagavad Gita with Penguin, Kalidasa's Shakuntala he's done, section of the Mahabharata for Penguin Palace, which I can't remember. And now he's working on, he's done work also for the play Sanskrit language. And he teaches Sanskrit, and I think your students actually perform these plays for them, or they?
Today
he's going to speak to us about playing around with Shakuntala, translating Sanskrit drama for performance.
More or less informal, I think, reflection on my experience about 5 or 6 years ago translating what I suppose is back then classical Sanskrit drama from Kalidasa Shakuntala. And it's also a reaction to what, for me at least, turned out to be an unexpected consequence of producing that translation. So this is not really an analysis of my method, because I don't think I had a method when I did it. It's really sort of a report after the event, but I haven't got too much like an official inquiry into some disaster. so that my aspiration is what I'm examining rather than my method. The result was this particular volume in the Oxford World Classics, which, if nothing else, I think has a cover. Okay. It came out in 2001, so this is some way behind me now, so this is very much a sort of analysis with hindsight, but it was triggered by something that I'll come to eventually, and I'll show you a little. So there's going to be three parts to this. The first is about the nature of Sanskrit drama, to some extent in general, but mostly how it's exemplified in this particular play. That's what I think about the problems that any translator of this text would be faced with. I'm not going to spend too much time on that, because I'm sure most of you know all about this already, and probably many of you know far more than I do about it, so I'm not going to show you that for very long. The second part is about some of the specific decisions I made about how to deal with or swerve around, in fact, a number of these problems in relation to my imagined audience, my perceived target audience, being the jargon translation studies. I'm not going to use the jargon translation studies again, as my slogan says, translation. And I'm going to also talk through a short example of how that was worked out in practice. And the third part is about the consequences of those decisions, and this is one particular unexpected consequence. So this paper is really more about form than content, so I'm not going to waste time getting a synopsis of the play, which most, if not all of you, probably know anyway. There's a reasonable consensus, I think, that it's also Kalidasa was a Brahmin who lived in northern India, perhaps in the late 4th to 5th century CE. Perhaps interesting to note that a recent poll of world authors conducted by the Nobel Institute that named Shakuntala as one of the 100 most important works in world literature. I'm not quite sure who they polled to establish this, but it's a fairly representative list. Don Quixote was a pop, I think. Anyway, Shakuntala was in there with one of my nine. It was translated, as you probably know, for the first time into a European language, English, by a Welshman, by Sir William Jones in 1789. And it got Goethe and others highly excited at the time. It was in a pretty admittedly some usually quite heavily cut Western productions, although on a scientific survey it seems to me, my impression is that these have trailed off somewhat since the Second World War, maybe kind of past to some extent. Broadly speaking, the plot point of an episode in the Great Sanskrit Epic, the Mahabharata, although I think like Shakespeare, what Kali Dasa does with the material, not its originality that counts. And one of the things he certainly does is to expand it, and you could argue, and I will argue, I think briefly, that his methods are quite late. So even as a piece devoid of the added performing practices, which I'll talk about presently, the full text of this play is long, and I think considerably longer than any Shakespeare, even Hamlet. So what about the form? I would translate it as the primary concern of form. This play has certain singularities which it shares with other Sanskrit dramas. Most of you are very familiar with these, so I won't spend too much time on them, but I should pull them out so I can come back to them when I look at what I did with it. The first is that in spite of being called a Sanskrit drama, it was in fact composed not just in Sanskrit, but in a number of Prakrit. By Kalidasa's time, and I think probably as far back as we can see, both Sanskrit and these particular Prakrit were, among other things, literary rather than natural languages. The literary Prakrit, which Sheldon Pollock described as grammaticized dialects, had by this time been divided into three or four regional types. But in spite of that, I think they were no longer actually associated with particular regions and were being used entirely for literary purposes. The manner in which Sanskrit and Prakrit are used in Shakuntala is standardized in this way, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. Sanskrit is spoken by high caste educated males, so by the king and his higher grade officials, by Brahmins and by male aesthetics. Females of whatever rank, young boys and other caste men speak different kinds of Prakrit. There are certainly exceptions to this, notably the stock comic Brahmin who is the king's companion, the Vidusha girl. And in spite of his high caste status, he speaks about Prakrit, partly in the comic effect, partly to illustrate his dubious character. Women of sufficient education, say aesthetics and culture terms, are also occasionally permitted to speak Sanskrit in these plays, although it doesn't really happen in Shakuntala. So how does this division of languages work in Shakuntala? In Act 1, for instance, the king speaks Sanskrit to the three women he meets in the hermitage. They, on the other hand, reply to him and speak to each other in Prakrit. And they will understand each other, as eventually, of course. Conventionally, a particular kind of Prakrit was put in with an out of a certain type of character. Royal women would speak one type, which is considered relatively refined, Chansaini, while uneducated characters would use another, considered appropriately uncouth. Similarly, one type of Prakrit would be used for prose, another for songs. However, it seems that Kalidasa was not wholly bound by this convention. Instead, he blended various Prakrit to exploit their dramatic effect. And in the words of one of his more recent translators, Margaret Stella Miller, he used them to complicate and enrich the verbal expressions of complex psychological states. I mean, I have to admit that this was a lot of the Prakrit to perceive his final distinction, but I'm prepared to take her word for it. If you accept this, then by Kalidasa at least, Prakrit were not being used entirely for mimetic purposes, purposes claimed by some modern commentators. Sheldon Pollock, for instance, claims that they're simply, quote, to provide local colour in drama through evoking, presumably, some idea or literary refashioning of what constitutes a local style. The second singularity of Sanskrit drama I want to draw attention to is that, at least according to the developed tradition, two other languages are employed in performance, although you barely glimpse them in the written text. These, of course, are the languages of music and movement. Just how particular part may trade in early performances of Shakuntala seems to me at least open to question. The later traditional assumptions about the use of these are drawn less from the plays themselves than from Bharata's Natya Shastra. Again, you probably know the stage is uncertain, but it seems that Karl Dalton was familiar with an early version of the text of that name. So it's, although the kind of context for that, what they were at that time is not known, I think. The later text, or compendium of texts, parts of which are clearly aware of Karl Dalton's play, claims to be the Veda for the drama. In other words, it tends to cover all aspects of theatrical production, as well as drama's more general function, and perhaps even its claim to have a wider significance as well. So, Public's treatise includes, for instance, sections on the mythical beginnings of drama, dance, there's music, ways of playing, aesthetics, gestures made of the eyes, eyeballs, eyes, out, mouth, and so on. But this is sort of a long list, but all kinds of things, including how the audience expresses, indeed how it should express its appreciation, and so on. But like all Shastra texts, I think it's quite difficult to distinguish between description and prescription, or indeed to chart a shift from localized description as it were to generalized prescription. So when, for instance, does an observed performance style become a norm? Anyway, whatever Karl Dalton's intentions, later performance tradition and many modern revivals certainly treat Shakuntala as a dance drama, more Natya than Natika, perhaps. Excuse me, that's how you get it. So these tend to lay on the full repertoire of hand, face, and bodily movements in addition to the spoken language. So it's clear that some mind at least was a necessary part of any production from the outset. But the style of such productions was, in some ways, I think, strikingly similar to Elizabethan drama. Plays were performed, it seems, largely on the bare stage, with rich costumes, hardly any props, accompanied by music. Unlike Elizabethan drama, however, male and female roles were usually played by the appropriate genders. And the stage was divided into invisible zones, and movements from one place to another was indicated by simply walking in a certain way. So this gives potential fluidity and freedom. As long as the audience accepts the convention, you can convey such actions as travelling at great speed in a flying chariot through a sort of combination of description or indication and simple mind. Probably familiar with that, so I'll stop to give an example. My favourite stage direction is Shakuntala reads, at least in my translation, and Shakuntala displays all the embarrassment of erotic attraction. Shakuntala, Sringara, Lajam, Rupayati. I think it's the whole Western actress faced with this, which is probably rather this on the radio. That's the turn I've been doing, actually. On the question of mine, it seems to me that there may be something to be said for distinguishing between mime and conventionalized semi-naturalistic gesture in general, which conveys information and which would not be otherwise unambiguously apparent to the audience, in other words, not fully given in their language or situation, between that kind of mime and a mime which duplicates or echoes in another register what is already there in the language. As a means of engendering this emotion or flame, this rustle, which I'll talk about presently, in a sort of more developed way. Perhaps, in pure speculation, this latter type of mind, GPK, taking the mind, if you like, took off at the point where most of the audience no longer understood much of the verbal language, which is a kind of translation, in fact. One of the translators of the Natya Shastra, Rangaracharya, credits Bharata with making the Sanskrit theatre intelligible to the uneducated by introducing the universal language of mudra and other gestures, although he thinks this happened before Karidasa. I mean, this of course raises the unanswered question of whether the language of mudra was any more intelligible for the uneducated than Prakrit or Sanskrit. I mean, what society is universal about it. But whatever the case historically, supposition, whatever the case historically, mime of all kinds has certainly been traditionally interpreted as an essential ingredient in engendering this experience of rasa, the particular experience which is falsely associated with a successful theatrical performance. The third singularity, Shakuntala, which I want to draw attention to, is that the play is in a mixture of verse and prose. In the recension I use, there are 183 verse passages in 22 different Sanskrit meters, as well as 9 verses in Prakrit, all but one of the latter either sung or recited by 8 different female characters. One character in particular, the king, speaks on average 64% of the Sanskrit verse in the 6,007 acts in which he appears. The senior male figure in the other act in which the king doesn't appear, Shakuntala, foster father, Kandava, also speaks that it's happened 64% of the verse in that act. And I think there are non-trivial reasons for this gender and character imbalance that I'll come to presently. Now, for the fourth singularity of this kind of drama, according to the Nātya Shastra, the purpose of the play is to inform, give knowledge of the world, and entertain, which I was thinking a bit like the reading TV theatre. However, the means by which a play achieves its effect on the audience are explained by the aesthetic principle which is usually labelled rasa theory. Post Kalidasa, no doubt you know, this gets developed in all kinds of ways, initially in relation to poetry and the other arts, and then as an important element in various theologies in the practice of Krishna Bhakti, for instance. A lot's been written about rasa, some of it contradictory, and the Nātya Shastra itself is frustratingly unclear in some crucial areas. Moreover, the developed theory, it seems to me, is frequently read back into the analysis of early Sanskrit drama in an alarmingly anachronistic way. So, for instance, Edwin Gerow, he's written two extensive and detailed articles on plot structure and the development of rasa and Shakuntala. And this is using the material from Radha Babasa's 15th century commentary, the perspective of later aesthetic theory. It gives the impression that the play is being constructed in a highly complex, rasa-directed, through a highly complex rasa-directed movement. It makes sense for high poetry, but I think hardly for a sort of performable drama. Nevertheless, I think rasa in important respects is essential to Shakuntala, although I would say not in this schematic or atomized way. Certainly, if you're asking in a general sense how they achieve its emotional and aesthetic effect on a Sanskritic audience, then rasa is the obvious way to describe it. As the Nātya Shastra itself says, there is no drama without the rasa. So, rasa, I won't say too much about it because I'm sure you've read about it already. Literally it means juice of flavour, so the essential metaphor is one of tasting. Who has the experience of tasting? Well, the audience, who provides it, the playwright, in combination with the performers. How is it done? According to Nātya Shastra, the precise purpose of all worthwhile drama is the creation of the principal emotions evoked within the play of a harmonious and complementary whole. And this in turn engenders a related but impersonal and universalized experience of joy and bliss in the audience. So it's a particular combination of poetry, action, plot, movement, sound and gesture which brings about this rasa. But, of course, it doesn't happen spontaneously. The poetry has to be good enough, the actors have to be good enough, and the audience has to be good enough. In other words, the audience needs to be trained or acculturated for the experience to occur. So, similarly occurs to me, it's a bit like taking an American to cricket match. Don't know what to expect. And the famous story of Groucho Marx going to Lord's and asking after going to go for an hour and then they're going to stop warming up. And I think it's quite common sense. Many Westerners, for instance, going to a cult in the past couple of years for the first time and often make them turn and stay again. So you can't assume that simply because you're presenting it to somebody that they'll understand it immediately. And what this means, I think, in terms of the sense of drama is that an audience of cognoscenti, educated in the faculties of this aesthetic, have their common response conditioned both by the specifics of the performance and by the dominant emotion or emotions that are out. So, as analysed in Nightingale and later literature, although laughter itself is a single ineffable experience in transcendental or rapture, subdivided, which is now according to emotions, or in principle, singleness of Vergil, and it's the actor's job to convey these by using all the physical, verbal, and psychological and decorative means which he's got at his disposal. And again, it's analysed the dominant Ruffin and Shakuntala, the erotic, physical, erotic, or romantic, Shandara flavour, corresponding to the emotion of love. This is supported by the analysis by auxiliary Ruffin, especially the Madeira or heroic Ruffin, evoked by the emotion of energy and closely associated with the king in his role as protector of the social and religious order. The king, in fact, as the hero of Naika, of Shakuntala, is the principal means by which Ruffa, what in order erotic, is activated. And this function then moves to the pathetic register, as it were, taken over by Shakuntala's foster father, Kamba, in that form. The king is presented as the ideal man of feeling, the Ruffica, or connoisseur of poetry, also known as the Sakharidaya, the ideal spectator, whose heart is at one with the author. The moment he feels an emotion, the Baba, he distills it through poetic utterance to its corresponding Rapa, and so favours it, becoming in a sense the spectator of his own feeling, while at the same time involving the audience in his desire and its dependent problem. Each particular instance adds to the unfolding of the Rapa and piece as a whole to the audience's favour, and this is the case for the high percentage of verses given to the kings of the sea, which I mentioned earlier. Now, a final comment before I go on to consider how I try to cope with some of these singularities I have to translate the play. The nature of Shakuntala, Sanskrit drama in general, implies a certain sophistication in the audience, that it should be cosmopolitan, literate, courtly, urban, and urbane, and educated in the convention. And it's certainly not clear to me whether such demands were ameliorated to any degree at all by movement and music, as I've already suggested, or whether these simply place a further set of complex demands on the audience. Almost certainly the latter, I think. It sounds like, again, it's sometimes claimed that music and movement are universal languages. That seems to me no more significant than saying language itself is universal. You've still got to learn how to rock and deliver them. If you don't understand, you still need to particular vocabulary, grammar, syntax, at some level, you still have to translate. If the Nachrichtanse was claimed that the drama is a fixed Vedic accessible to all castes and classes, if it refers to all those involved in the production, the Smith, Carmen, the Sages, etc., then in terms of the large production, then it may well be true, and it's perhaps analogous to those involved in the great Vedic ritual. But if it refers to the audience, I'm not sure how you square the apparent democratic instinct of Nagi Shastri with the actual form of Sanskrit drama. And I think there's also much suspicion here that the modern revival of interest in classical drama entails something of a tendency to see it as more socially encompassing than it may actually have been the case. It's possible, I suppose, that the Nazi Shastra may here be talking sheerly in terms of the spectacle and event rather than a more engaged understanding, and learning the experience of Russia. But whatever the case, I think that Kalidasa's core audience must have been sophisticated. Romola Tatmar is surely correct when she says that the play was performed at the quarter and court festival was more discerning and sophisticated audience. fact, the playwright himself makes the character of his ideal audience, or the corporate woman, necessarily is the actual one. He makes the character of that audience clear enough in the prologue to Shikun Palava, but he has his actor manager say, it's only when the cobbler shares the applause, and only then a director can afford to believe his master of his craft, even the most devout and highly trained practitioner still self-doubt. So, now I get to my own translation and how I've attempted to deal with these singularities of sense of drama, and sort of certain other singularities as well, but picked out those four. Well, my first decision, I think, really dictated all those that followed, and I decided that I had to produce a performable version. Partly this was because I didn't think that any of the other translations I had looked at were strikingly performable, and mine at least might differ in that respect. But also, I mean, it's a personal thing, I have a long-standing interest in theatre, and so I know the play only really comes alive in performance, and they come alive in performance in ways that you can't really imagine when you simply read them on the pages of literary text. So I was going to choose the performable over the solely literary. I wasn't saying I was going to consciously abandon the literary altogether, and I'll say a bit about that presently. I'm saying performable here, but I don't think it's quite the same thing as performing, since I would take the performing version to be one that would tailor to a very specific the requirements of a specific production. So I'm thinking of a performable version as being one that has the potential to become a performing version, if you like, without too much tweaking. So once you've decided that you're translating for performance, it seems to me that you have to be totally pragmatic. The only thing that counts then is what works, in other words, what communicates the desired effect to the audience. Of course, there's a catch with that, and that's that you don't always know what works or what is likely to work until you've seen it before, and it's sort of too late. And of course, it's the reason why new plays and lots of new plays often change quite radically in rehearsal. And that's what the performance version is usually made. But I only really have the sort of luxury of that in a very limited way, and I tried out bits of it with the students from time to time. But so mostly I have to rely on my own experience of the performance mostly as a member of an audience, to imagine what might and might not work. So effectively I was directing a kind of performance in my head through the translation process. So the result is that the translation carries within it the seeds of its own staging, I hope. And I read recently a remark by a theatre director and translator, Antoine Vitez, who said that ideally the translation ought to dominate the mise-en-scène, not the reverse. And I wouldn't disagree with that, I mean, ideally, of course. I think it's probably trying to apply them a different way to all translation. I mean, I think it may be significant that one of the very few readable books, in my view, on the nature and problems of literary translation by Michael Robert Wexler, it's called Performing Without a Stage. And in fact, in the book, he barely mentions the theatre at all. He didn't think that all translations were a performance. Now, as you might guess, my perception of my audience and how it was different from Carly Dance has turned out to be the crucial factor here. This isn't the same as saying you're attempting to give the audience what it wants or what it's comfortable with necessarily, but I think it is about the limits of what's communicable or effectively communicable. And I've argued in terms of a particular performance style that's associated with conventions, Carly Dance was writing to an audience of Cockney Shanty or Connoisseur. Now, the audience for my translation would be completely different from what they would be Cockney Shanty in that sense. I attempted to translate a very sort of second order problem, shared, as it were, academic specialists in the field. They don't need much translation, the originals themselves, and there are other translations there. So, I didn't think of them as my primary audience, I don't think my publisher did either. My publisher probably did think there was a student audience, but again, maybe I was slightly involved with that. Incidentally, I was talking about them, so they're not here. I didn't meet them in the street before, but some of you may know, he's got a new translation coming out in July, the Sanskrit Library, which uses the, for the first time, the translation of the Kashmiri translation. So it's really worthwhile thing, and it's very interesting to read, read on the page. So mine's not in that, particular game, more that. It's targeted more as a sort of generally educated Western audience and not specialist. I mean, ideally, certainly, I do perform sometimes, somebody be sitting in a provincial theatre, or it's not easy with their grandfather watching this and sitting something out. This is the audience I was essentially thinking about when I did this. So in other words, I couldn't afford to assume what Carly Jarvis could assume. And if I translated him without reimagining and using his principal assumptions, obviously including those dramatic styles, all the dimensions of drama and Sanskrit in the 5th century CE, what I translated wouldn't be performable. It wouldn't communicate anything significant in modern audience. Since it went on his assumptions and turned it over like that. This raises plenty of other problems, of course, and I think not the least of these is the apparent over-transparency of the plain English. If you haven't, without benefit of footnotes, which are pretty obviously unperformable, I guess, and particularly if it's cut from its original length, it can seem like just another fairy tale, or even in the form of, I think, an exotic pantomime. So once you've gone down this line, then your only defence really from this is maybe in attempting to convey, however inadequately, some of the play's literary quality, and so it's flavour or rougher in a sort of shifted or transformed thing. And I would say that in general, what I was trying to do was to move the play from the highly stylized and artificial in the linguistic and dramatic sense towards something more naturalistic and something more in tune with current Western performance style. If you object, this is not the play that it was written, then I would reply, you are not the audience it was written for. A bit clear, but and I do think the audience, your potential audience, governs what you do. I think that's the essential thing. To quote Antoine Vitez again, it is just this which characterizes translation, the fact that it must be perpetually redone. Everything must be played again and again, and everything must be taken up and retranslated. In other words, translation is in itself an image of theatrical art. Every production of Shakuntala, every translation of Shakuntala, if it's any good, tells us something new or different about the play. And of course, no production or translation, however brilliant, outlasts its time. Nobody now reads Chapman's Homer in live text, beginning of the 19th century, I guess. Even the King James Bible is no longer currency, I guess, except for specialists and expressionists. So, calling to the Church of England, no doubt. We can lament about that, but I don't think that's sort of growing old. It's the one thing that we don't do on the whole is to translate translations. We don't go to Chapman and then try and translate him into modern English, having to convey his literary claims. If I do, I think we go back to the original. Every generation does its own thing with it. So this brings me on. How much time have you got, Kevin?
How much time do you need?
Quite a bit more, actually. 15
minutes?
I'll try to go. I haven't got my actual copy, but I'm trying to ignore what it's telling me. very quickly, this brings on to how I dealt with the first singularity, which is some of the mix of languages, and I think this was very easy. Like every other translator, I simply ignored it and treated the play as monolingual. And I mean, it might be because it's not insoluble, it's not a problem at all. And of course, academics don't like to hear that things are insoluble, and everyone has their own ideas immediately about how you do this. You know, you get the women will speak Welsh or French, and commentary will all speak in Wolverhampton accents and so on, but it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work in practice. Sort of I think a post-war American translation of Ivan Denisovich, where the inhabitants of the Gulag were all GIs and speaking American slang. Well, seems to me the equivalent of that. I mean, introduced strange accents and so on from your own cultural context, so things just fall apart. I mean, it's not to say that there are, of course, examples of sort of multilingual theatre. There are, but they are again very specific. So what I attempted to do was convey the differences in the way the characters speak through sort of life changes in idiom, so to speak, or perhaps more technically by replacing left or text, so to say, with syntactic effects, which is the mind in a sense. But some things are more possible because one type of character than another, so you can always give comic characters sort of standard sort of gold line accents or something if you want to go that way. How you can find the difference between people of the same class essentially but the different genders speaking to each other in different languages. I mean, if you come up with an ingenious solution, I think delighted to hear it, although I'm delighted to see it in practice. But yeah, I mean, maybe someone operating say in Indian English in the British Asian context might get some of this. I don't know what for me to say. Skip a bit. Go for the second solution. This comes as an assumption in multi-form performance style, including the Italian gestures and music. I mean, you could say that that's not the translator's problem, but I think if you're translating the performance, then it certainly could become one. Sanskrit dramas are leisurely, after all you need to say to the rasa, and so they take time to perform. And if you add in dance, movement, continual sort of face and body gestures, they take even longer. And of course, originally they may be longer, and often performed in installments or at least over a whole night, and and so on. I mean, clearly the original audiences, if you like, were expected to see these plays time and time again, and they deepened their experience with each performance, they were relishing or tasting slight and subtle variations on a well-known theme. But of course, modern Western audiences, on the other hand, will only like to see a play once, and like Shakespeare and connoisseurs of Shakespeare, but most of the audience is not made of connoisseurs in that sense. So to expand on this a little, but one thing needed by connoisseurs, and here I mean nothing more than an acculturated audience, is time. You need repeated, close contact with the story that in one sense is extremely already known, well known, from the cradle, as it were. But what you can derive from that kind of contact isn't instantly realised. It requires training. It requires training in terms of habituation and concentrated exposure. Which is a point made by the great Kashmiri Shaivati, a legend of another Gupta, drawing on developing Rasa theory in the 10th century. Here describing the most sensitive readers of poetry, Kavya, the sensitive readers are those whose mirror-like minds are made crystal clear by their constant practice of the reading of poetry in such a way that their minds become identified with whatever is described in poetry. Translation by writing. And I think that's an awfully long way from the conditions that apply to most modern audiences. Obviously, the economics of one theatre and ticket prices tend to encourage connoisseurship in that sense. You could hardly blame translator if she and he decided to go for a kind of novelisation of things, that's one thing you did on the page, and you don't actually attempt to take it into performance. I rather rashly perhaps decided that I would try to create something that was performable within the conventions of Western theatre, but to do that I found I actually had to some extent to counter the connoisseur's approach. In fact, I had to work against the grain of the rasa, as it were. one of my strategies was to speed up the delivery of what was already for a Western audience along with some of that phrase. And I didn't want to do this by cutting the text of the poetry, however well or ill translated. You need that if you're going to have any chance of conveying some of the effect. So I didn't cut, but I wanted to sort of drive the action forward through the language. My assumption was that apart from the usual gestures and maybe some naturalistic mind, the actor wouldn't require extra time to do other things that he or she spoke the line. In other words, they wouldn't need to employ the full panoply of coded gestures that you get in traditional performances of this material. And as we'll see, that turned out to be a very rash assumption. Perhaps say a little bit about the verse quickly. As you know, meter and Sanskrit verses write patterns of light and heavy syllables, whereas English verse and meter is mostly, but not exclusively, derived from patterns of stress. I decided not to try and mirror the variety of Sanskrit verbs in English. I mean, I'm not sure I can find 31 different English verses to turn it into anyway. I thought clear that out as an idea. But in fact, I wanted a more unified tone across verses, especially those spoken by the same character. While largely to create some kind of identifiable tone and rhythm for the piece in English, and I don't want to call that rougher, but it's something moving in that direction. At the same time, I didn't want to ignore the verse completely and sort of flatten it all out into a uniform prose. Most of our verses, which kind of look like verse on the page, I mean, verse passages look like verse on the page, obviously. But they're actually nevertheless in prose, or what gets called rhythmic prose, which I never understand, or prose rhythmic. Anyway, I rejected that idea, and what I did for better and no better words was to suggest the verse and its range of different meters, to some extent the difference between Sanskrit and Prakrit verses, by using, sometimes using rhyme, sometimes using half rhyme, assonance, alliteration, and at the very least looking for something that was a bit more pronounced or a simple prose rhythm. I won't go matching the original or anything like places. And again, my guideline was what I thought would work in performance, and so I was looking for a way in which it could retain the verse at the same time that could express it fluently, speedily and naturally by the actor. So I wanted to know the verse and prose to flow fairly seamlessly in and out of each other. Michael Coulson, an earlier translator, lightly compared the difference between the prose and verse passages for that between recitative and aria in opera, and in those terms I'm aiming for something closer to a dramatic aria than simply a beautiful song setting the action. Very quickly, I can show you what I did in a particular verse, and this is which is on the Hamlet. This is a hard case, and the rush of me has dished this one out really, and I'm not really satisfied with the result. You will probably notice almost immediately as I'm trying to go through this that I did something pretty heretical here in my translation. I tend to do fairly heretical things anyway in translation, but it's probably an extreme case. But apart from the treatment of the verse, I think this example also demonstrates something about how rapture and emotion are invoked through language, and how Sanskrit and English need different means if they're to accomplish similar ends. So the example, you may know, comes from a group of Sanskrit verses in Act 4. Translated on a hiding for nothing here from the start, because according to literary legend, as you may also know, this act is the greatest. Supposed to be the greatest act in Sanskrit drama, and these verses were the pinnacle of Sanskrit poetry, and so it's like the same Norwegian thing that's being presented as to be or not to be. I should have heard it just some day. You just forget about it and just do what you can. This verse is the most, I think, the most famous of these. It's spoken by Sandra. She comes with a foster father, as his pregnant daughter prepares to leave the forest to join the king in the court. This was a form of Sanskrit music called Sharduna Vikrijita, a tiger's play, which has 19 syllables for the rhyme of Pada. Indicated up on the handout, the pattern of heavy and light syllables, so you can see that it's entirely regular. That's what we do with the final syllables, but it's not entirely regular. My translation of this pattern is also syllabically regular, but in an entirely different way. My usual aim in translating verse is compression, which is again predicated on a certain non-traditional style of performance, and in this case the Sanskrit original has 76 syllables and my translation comes in at 56, and here I'm using syllables as a rough guide to the relative time it takes to speak something. I'm not in connection with the meter. It's simply a guide here to, of course, the Sanskrit. The meter decided by number of syllables and all that in their pattern, but here I wanted to indicate in a rough way the time in which it's likely to take somebody speaking this fairly normally without sort of added extras, time it's going to take them to deliver it. My syllable count, by the way, particularly in French and probably in English, is maybe a bit fuzzy, but it's giving a rough indication. So Carles is probably the most literal of these translations. Sometimes it's not actually in grammatical English at all, and mine may well be the least literal, I think. I think I'm going to let you read that yourself, since I'm running out of time with one or two other things I'd like to say. What I wanted, essentially, was to relocate the emotional centre of gravity. In the original, it's embedded in the speaker's description of his own sorrowful emotional state, which he then projects onto fathers in general. I didn't want to change the emotion itself, but I did want a more enacted and characterised expression of it. You might think that the difference, the achieved difference, is actually marginal. But my translation does, to some extent, deliberately, I think, work against some of the principles of Sanskrit aesthetics or rather this. For a start, simply in terms of duration, it doesn't allow so much taking of the emotion, but it's a common sense. More significantly, I think, as I suggested, I took a pragmatic decision to relocate the emotion to a place where those trained in the Western performance tradition, in other words, actor and audience, might have a better hope of finding it, at least, in my opinion. And I attempted to do this by getting as much emotional force as possible into the active realisation that Shakuntala must leave today. And in the first instance, this involves changing the original Yasiti and she will leave or she leaves to an ineluctable must. In fact, quite a certain minute, that's pretty much the same thing. Next, I rendered the Hiki clause, the Sanskrit, into direct speech. Shakuntala must leave today, where some others chose the indirect. Such as my heart is touched with sadness since Shakuntala must go today. At the thought that Shakuntala is to go away today, my heart is smitten with grief, and so on. And again, I think their indirection, the last two examples, is quite in tune with the erotic intention of the original. It's a kind of savouring of the sorrowful emotion associated with the current erotica on behalf of the audience that is at the heart of it. It's a savouring that takes the form of, I am thinking to myself that Shakuntala will leave today because of that I am sad. The cause of his sadness, Shakuntala leaving, is in some ways the least important element. And it's taken a step further, taken a step further since by the end of the verse in the original, the strength of Chamba's personal emotion, how the strongly or mildly expressed, has been further generalised in good Russellized passion to worldly violence. So this famous verse seems to me is not in the play to tell us about Kamba's character. It's there to induce a certain situation where aesthetic response in the audience. In a sense, he tells us, the worldly partners in the audience, what to feel. We don't make the connection directly, so it's generalised for us too. We're invited to savour it. Now, it seems to me that this aesthetic is unlikely to have the same effect on a Western audience of non-connoisseurs. We tend to empathise with characters rather than generalised emotions. And therefore what it does is instinctively perhaps to bring the emotion back to the character. And I took 3 hours to do it to begin with, but then with the help of a rhyme, I realised that Cumber should repeat his initial assertion where there is no repeat in the original. What is happening to him finally sinks in at the end of the verse. For some of you this may be shocking, unrepentable, but I wasn't particularly satisfied with it myself either. It's probably just my confidence that I couldn't get that what I wanted there without doing the repeat, but I did the repeat, it's not there in the original. No one seems to notice it, it's probably no one that should read the translation, and I might as well point it out in those But just to develop that a little quickly before I show you something on the DVD. It seems to me that in most Western drama, the actor finds the emotion in the line and then enacts it through the language, where the language and therefore the emotion belongs to the character. The emotion is preferred to characterize. In Sanskrit drama, on the other hand, the emotion is generalized. The hero is both the medium of the emotion and its connoisseur. The rustica. The ultimate aim is to enable the rustica. So you get this assertion by some Western academics that characters in Sanskrit drama are stereotypes. Of course, the important thing is not the development of character, but the rustica generated by the medium of language and gesture. The idea, in fact, is that the experience of the performance, the differences between character, actor, and audience should disappear or be transcended by the aesthetic experience of rustica should be created. Perhaps just say briefly that another of the big great differences seems to me between Western and drama and stage caricature is that a lot of Western drama gets its effect from ambiguity, and that's been written about most recently Jonathan Bayes, I think, but again on William Anderson as well. So a lot of the effect of Shakespeare comes from the ambiguity it reflects our sort of uncertainties and our presence about situations and people. But it seems to me, in this particular drama, I'm not saying it's true necessarily for Spanish drama in general, but it seems to me there is no ambiguity in that sense, and there's not supposed to be any ambiguity in that sense, but in terms of what we're supposed to feel. And in fact, if you compare Kalidasa's version with the Mahabharata version, which partly at least probably is true, he deliberately removes all possible ambiguity comes up, and in particular in relation to the character of the king. So as far as the audience is concerned, there's nothing hidden in the character or situation. Everything is in the emotion and the rustica and the intensity and perception of the meeting of language and emotion in performance. So in short, it's not actually like life at all. It's not supposed to be like life at all. It's idealized, and it's like it's made sort of linguistic meaning sense, but it's refined and artificially. There's never any doubt about what we're supposed to feel, because we're told in language, gesture, and music precisely what it is that we should or need to be feeling. Of course, the problem is, or the only problem in a way, is having sufficient sensibility and sensitivity to understand that specific experience of language of rustica and emotion. As I suggested, that requires training as well as sometimes inherent susceptibility. And I would say it's that lack of ambiguity, that sort of emotional directness, which accounts for this feeling of what I call transparency, the feeling that there's nothing hidden, that everything is on the surface of the language when we encounter these things in translation. So without the record betraying or cultivation, what we tend to be left with is a sort of shadow of the poetry, which is notoriously impossible to translate at any kind of similar level of achievement. So what I'm suggesting is that the only way you can get back to something like the rustica from a different direction is actually in performance. You're not going to get it on the page, as it were, and that, of course, largely depends on your actors and the director and so on. But I think translators can help performers in that respect by, as it were, embedding their needs on the in the translation as much as they can. I mean, translators don't give as much help as performers the cost of the camp, the whole people have a take down performance tradition from style in mind. And so, I mean, it's clear from what I've been saying at the moment of what kind of performance style in mind, it's a sort of Western language directed performance that's going to be swift, there's not going to be too much, going to be necessary movement and music and song, but not too much. It wasn't going to try and sort of replicate all sort of traditional Sanskritic performances, traditional sort of Indian performances in more general terms. That's how I envisaged it. Well, I had a real shock a few years ago because it came to my notice far a small addition to my royalties, but some place called Pomona College in San Francisco in America put on a performance using my translation, and I got into some correspondence with the woman who was responsible for directing, Betty Bernard. And she told me about what they were doing, and eventually it sent me a couple of DVDs. Now, this is an adult performance done with students. If I may, I'll just read you an extract from one of her emails to me to say what she was intending. She said, "I took it this translation to India with me, and after much discussion with my Indian theatre friends and colleagues there, my co-director, Kailash Pandya, head of drama at Dubna Academy in Ahmedabad, cut the play down to a 2-hour version. Our rehearsal period was only 12 weeks, and I'm not the only one. We're going to get about 6 weeks. But they needed it. I mean, as she says, in order to do the play in Nati Shastra's style, it wasn't time to accommodate the full version and do it properly. The actors were nearly all first semester students from all disciplines imaginable, like Shakuntala as a neurobiology major, for example, with no experience with any Indian performing arts, so we rehearsed 3 to 4 hours nightly plus extra rehearsals during the day with the lead characters. The choreographer also from Dublin Academy has a lot of experience in teaching American students movements and getting their bodies to move in a proper fashion. Connecting movements to speech proves the most challenging aspect. One has to have a choreographer to do this. The shlokas require accompanying movements to make them fully flat. We have a musical school composed by a well-known composer, Mr. Atul, in India. I wanted live music because I've read the necessary funds to do that on top of the expense of bringing 2 artists here for 13 weeks. The costumes were organised and built in Ahmedabad and carried over the suitcases of 2 Indian artists, but I can hardly believe it. But as you'll see, they must have had extremely large suitcases and charter the planes of this. It's Dublin Academy of Performing Arts, as she explained, was founded in 1949 by her husband and wife in Paradise. It's now run by their daughter Marika, who some of you will have seen as Draupadi in the Vision Book version of the Mahabharata. It has what is described as an academic experimental bent, and Kailash Pandya, the head of the theatre department, is a very well known actor and director, is now in his 80s. So now I'll show you an extract from this. I mean, I'm not going to tell you what I think of it, but.
Right at the end. Wow.
The
what is that?
Paul when it comes in, has to see this extra line in there. I did, I've been the folly of putting it in the line. Very colourful.
Thank you.
yeah, I imagine more kind of productive than this. Got the one that I thought I was
battled against in some respect, battled against in terms of going actually against the grain of the scientific tradition against the production of rap.
How would you feel about the radio?
Well, I think that might work better, certainly. I mean, there is a radio version of Michael Coulson's translation, which is well heard about from time to time, but they cut it so heavily that there's none of the verse there. There are actually none of the verse, but it comes like it, and you've got this fairy tale. I think you've got to have the verse, but even, well, I'm not making claims for that translation of the verse, but I think the verse has got to be there. Whoever translated in whatever fashion, or right? You know, the reason for the play disappears.
Entertainment, I mean, I shouldn't be
too critical of it, because it's amazing that they managed to do what they did, I think, from time to time. But on the other hand, I don't think they had an audience in mind, and I don't think they thought.
Where did
this? It was in California, so it's called Pomona College.
Pomona College?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was there, Malika was there,
But, on the other hand, I think it was just, in a way, learning and teaching and learning is good for the students, isn't it? Yeah. They learn a lot undoubtedly. But as a performance, as a star, particularly star of performance, I don't think it works. Well, anyway, I haven't given the chance to see that. So that's my question. Yeah.
It makes me think of
those
issues that come up in the way of modern Shakespeare, I think. You talk about the issue of brother and something which in time for execution of universalization and sublimation, and that's the essence of emotion. And it's an interesting point about how in the West we aren't geared to that very much.
Yeah.
It seems largely true, although actually it doesn't seem so different to Shakespeare to me, where characters will start as personal and through a great deal of work, service, rather than universal.
Yeah.
It seems to be quite a common feature of civilities in Shakespeare, and perhaps if we weren't too scared of putting in modern language, as you say, the language gets a bit lost, but perhaps it keeps the words, and that being really what drives the universal and forces to have that extra limitation. It seems to be common that people want to reduce effects, whereas actually maybe we should save our time, and if we can, and sort of let the audience breathe into that more.
Yeah, I'm sure it leads to them, figuring my audience too much away. I've got to give them more help here, but they can run out of the credit.
We're doing a particular type of performance, and obviously in terms of constraints. It occurred to me that you could actually do it for a DVD. Not a DVD for the performance, but do it for a DVD and forget all the constraints of time.
Yeah.
And cut virtually nothing. And add all the mind and music that you want. I think that in fact many more people would be able to respond to that than international. I think that's too much of an idea what people want without the
government.
I think they will if it's good enough.
Yes, I have to, but they need something to the initiative, I can understand what's happening here, or I've got some idea of what's happening here, and then they can make the further effort. But I'm having a hung up a bit on this idea of seeing the transparency in the language when you translate this. I mean, that may be my fault, but it's not in the translation, but I don't know, how do you get beyond the thing that you've simply got something sort of exotic and everything flat in a way.
Then you do it.
Yeah.
and people there would understand.
Yes.
Is it act?
Yes.
Where does that come from?
Yes, I mean, let's say I think that in the distinction between seeing as something and seeing as simply duplicate. So, I mean,
the other one to talk about which an audience is only because I don't see that the Indian audiences are actually beating down the doors to get to Shankaracharya. It's a different word, they don't understand the surely a little bit more than Western audience. But it's still a why not and I was thinking of your translation. Wouldn't it go really well with Shakuntala in modern dress? No object.
Yeah.
No furniture. In fact, going naturally. Shakespeare does work. It's not all of it, but done well, it works very well in modern dress.
Arguably, the power of the language will come through more powers.
Yes, modern dress is what coming? Or is it a Western? Don't be very much.
Sorry.
Yeah. that precisely why you find these things are done more as dance drama,
yeah,
rather than just, you know, talking. Because that's the only way you can hold the audience, and the rest of them get something. You don't find the kind of talk that would be more the dance or rather than dance. The other one.
Yeah,
yeah. But they don't use logical
theory. Well, it's difficult to show that young woman, I mean, follow in hand,
work. Well, you're all
in Russia, there's a dance group there, and they're dedicated to this Sanskrit drama, and they put everything in the original Sanskrit. And the words of the sound actually. They put the music and all that. And they hear much
and
all the indicators are completely intact. I watched one in Sanskrit. And she acted in the college play. And it was combined, you know, Shankara and my Kalidasa's impact is heavy. Direction is so correct. Only I have been after a group. I was able to follow the law. I haven't read the text, but it was very, the impact was very great. And they wrote about it in the newspapers the next day.
In
Ujjain,
they used to do it every year, at least in every college. And we have done the impact. But that goes in the things I don't know about.
Kidding me, poo. I thought I could burn all my in the bag of opera and then you got it.